Today is Thursday, March 26th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. World leaders are set to gather virtually today to develop a coronavirus response.
The threats to embargo the export of medical equipment from China to the U.S., including protective gear, and the war of words between government officials about the national origins of the virus indicates that we probably have not yet found the floor.
Plus, how the pandemic is affecting the crisis in Yemen.
Humanitarian organizations warn that a coronavirus outbreak there would be tragic.
We'll have those stories and more next. Italy, the United States, and Spain are now among the key centers in the fight against the global coronavirus outbreak, according to the latest statistics on confirmed cases. Spain's parliament approved a government request to extend the country's state of emergency and a lockdown, requiring businesses to close and people to stay home at least through mid-April. John Hopkins University is currently tracking nearly 500,000 global cases of COVID-19. The coronavirus is also blamed for at least 21,000 deaths. At Wednesday night's White House coronavirus briefing, Dr. Anthony Fauci of the U.S. National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases said, because the Southern Hemisphere is just beginning to report cases of COVID-19, it may become a seasonal disease globally.
We're having cases that are appearing as they go into their winter season. And if, in fact, they have a substantial outbreak, it will be inevitable that we need to be prepared that we'll get a cycle around the second time.
The eastern Chinese city of Shanghai will make all incoming travelers undergo 14 days of quarantine and observation in a bid to prevent coronavirus transmission. Shanghai had previously required travelers to go into quarantine only if they had visited 24 badly hit countries in the past 2 weeks before their arrival in the city. Japan has also banned entry from Europe on Thursday and warned of a high risk that the coronavirus could become rampant after a surge of cases in Tokyo. The government also asked its citizens to refrain from all non-essential travel in Tokyo this weekend to curb the spread of COVID-19. In an unprecedented video conference of G7 foreign ministers, global leaders pledged to work together to battle the coronavirus outbreak. The United States says it is ready to work with China to end the global pandemic and restore the world economy. But as VOA's State Department correspondent Nike Ching reports, some analysts are skeptical about the ability of the two countries to cooperate to fight the global pandemic.
Streets and popular landmarks across the world are empty due to restrictions amid the COVID-19 outbreak. Outside China, Italy, the United States, and Germany are among the G7 nations that are hardest hit by the deadly virus. In a Wednesday video conference, foreign ministers of the G7 pledged to cooperate to fight the global pandemic, with Secretary of State Mike Pompeo noting Washington's willingness to work with Beijing.
This is a global pandemic. This is something the United States wants to work with every country, including China, to figure out how to resolve, to keep as many people alive, as many people as healthy, and then to restore our economies that have been decimated by the Wuhan virus.
As China has worked to tame the spread of coronavirus within its own borders, it has also shipped out medical supplies to countries like Italy, a move seen as trying to supplant the U.S. as the global power. U.S.-China relations were already on the decline long before the pandemic. Analysts say the worldwide crisis has only worsened ties. National University of Singapore's Drew Thompson spoke to VOA via Skype.
The threats to embargo the export of medical equipment from China to the U.S., including protective gear, and the war of words between government officials about the national origins of the virus indicates that we probably have not yet found the floor of the bilateral relationship, and tensions are probably going to continue and potentially even get worse.
While the G7 foreign ministers did not issue a joint statement, in part due to the reported difference on referring the coronavirus as Wuhan virus, members vowed to act together to pursue a vaccine, bring home citizens stranded abroad, and safeguard the global economy. Nike Chin, VOA News, State Department.
The number of Americans filing claims for unemployment benefits shot to a record 3.28 million as strict measures to contain the pandemic ground the economy to a sudden halt. The measures unleashed a wave of layoffs that likely brought an end to the longest employment boom in U.S. history. The jobless blowout was announced shortly after Federal Reserve Chairman Jay Powell said on NBC's Today show that the U.S. may well be in a recession. But progress in controlling the spread of the coronavirus will dictate when the economy can fully reopen. The U.S. Senate unanimously passed a $2 trillion stimulus bill Wednesday evening, aimed at helping unemployed workers and industries hurt by the coronavirus pandemic. Reuters' Gloria So reports.
The bill is passed.
The divided Senate came together to vote 96-0.
I'm proud to announce tonight not a single senator voted against this $2 trillion rescue bill to save American individuals, small businesses, large businesses, and to provide considerable funding for the healthcare workers and the scientists and the doctors and others who are trying to solve this pandemic.
It's the largest rescue package in American history. Included in the stimulus package, direct payments of up to $3,000 to U.S. families, up to $500 billion for distressed industries, including hard-hit airlines. Businesses owned by President Trump, other administration officials, and members of Congress are not eligible for assistance. $250 billion to expand unemployment aid, $100 billion for hospitals and related health systems, and $350 billion for small business loans. The stimulus package amounts to nearly half of what the U.S. government spends annually. Senate Minority Leader Chuck Schumer was overjoyed about passing the bill.
I always had faith we would, because America and the American people demanded it. And so when we passed this bill on the floor of the Senate, we didn't hug each other. We just waved from a distance.
It is intended to flood the economy with cash to stem the impact of an intensifying pandemic that has killed more than 900 people in the United States and infected at least 60,000. Trump also told reporters on Wednesday he would sign it into law as soon as it reached his desk.
Gloria So reports for Reuters News. Yemen's brutal civil war has now entered its fifth year, with no serious prospects in sight for its end. Concerns mount over a coronavirus outbreak there, given its shattered medical system. The Norwegian Refugee Council says it has been unable to reach people in Yemen with badly needed humanitarian aid, where authorities have imposed strict measures to halt the spread of the virus. Although Yemen has yet to report any COVID-19 cases, its fragile healthcare system would be overwhelmed by an outbreak. The NRC and other humanitarians warn. Dale Gavlek reports.
Yemen is already home to the world's worst humanitarian crisis, according to the United Nations, and so humanitarian organizations warn that a coronavirus outbreak there would be tragic. Since 2016, Yemen has struggled with a suspected 1.3 million cholera cases. Such cases are expected to rise for years to come because of ongoing conflict and a fragile health system, according to the UN. Sultana Begum is Yemen advocacy manager for the Norwegian Refugee Council. She tells VOA that Yemenis will find it hard to protect themselves against the COVID-19 pandemic as fighting continues to rage between Saudi-backed government forces and Iranian-supported Houthi rebels.
We are extremely, extremely concerned about any possible outbreak because it will have catastrophic consequences for displaced people. After 5 years of war, there's been a lot of damage and destruction to thousands of hospitals, water and sanitation systems. And then on top of that, Yemen was already reeling from other diseases like dengue fever and cholera. We have a lot of displaced people who lack access to water, to healthcare. Even washing your hands is very difficult. You're living in desert-like, overcrowded camps, never mind self-isolating.
There is also alarm over the Houthi rebels' use of shutting down schools, citing COVID-19 concerns. Gulf analyst Cinzia Bianco of the European Council on Foreign Relations says this is just the latest ploy by the Houthis to enlist more recruits as their fighting intensifies both in the Maghreb region and near the Saudi border. Bianco tells VOA that she expects to see the coronavirus also impact the ability of parties on both sides of the conflict to wage war.
I think it will spread quite quickly, and in 3 months from now, we will see a peak level of contagion in Yemen to the point that it will definitely and necessarily impact also political groups, militias, and everyone who is involved in the war.
British Yemen expert Helen Lackner says she doesn't think much can be done to protect the Yemenis from the coronavirus. Both the Houthi rebels and United Arab Emirates-backed southern separatists, she says, are preventing precautionary measures from being put into place.
Southern forces in Aden have prevented WHO supplies from being left out of the airport so they could reach government people, and that's a lot of serious supplies. The so-called quarantine areas that have been set up in the Houthi areas, which do everything except protect anyone from anything. On the contrary, and they're basically disease breeding grounds.
Citing published reports, Lackner tells VOA that the UAE-backed southern separatists prevented 81 ambulances and 15 mobile health clinics from being released to combat disease. Dale Gavlek for VOA News, Amman.
And still to come.
It's always been fascinating to know why the country has voted for change when it has and why at times it prefers stability.
You're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
In December, an online report on the Astronomer's Telegram website indicated the star Betelgeuse was decreasing in brightness. This set off headline-grabbing speculation that the variable red supergiant star was getting ready to explode into a spectacular supernova. Since then, a number of astronomers have refuted this assumption, with some saying it might go supernova in about 10 to 100,000 years from now. Astronomers at Louisiana State University, citing their research, recently suggested that a binary system called V Sagittae will explode when the two stars crash into and merge with each other around the year 2083. They say that this explosion will make it the most luminous star in the Milky Way galaxy. The binary system is currently described as being barely visible, even with mid-sized telescopes. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. The Muslim holy month of Ramadan, which begins in late April, usually marks the peak period for Muslims performing Umrah. But in view of the fast spread of the coronavirus, Saudi Arabia's decision to temporarily ban its citizens and foreign residents from performing the Umrah has changed all travel plans. The outbreak of coronavirus could also potentially affect the much larger annual pilgrimage. VOA senior analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi spoke with Mohammed Khalil, vice president of Adam Travel, one of the top providers of Umrah and pilgrimage packages for American Muslims, about the impact of the virus on the travel business.
It impacted it in a way like never before. Business has closed, all travel business, specifically Umrah. We anticipate, and the Saudi authorities have made it clear, that there will be no Umrah business during Ramadan this year. So there will be no sales.
There are already visas and air tickets issued. There are also hotel reservations made in Mecca and Medina. What will happen to them?
The hotels have been the most reasonable. For the most part, they have refunded because of the ban. However, they have not been as eager to refund the deposits for future bookings, even though more than likely those will also be canceled. The airlines have been giving refunds in some cases, but other cases they have not been giving refunds, which again has been difficult. And the Saudi government has not refunded anyone for the tourist visas. So that has been a lost cost that has been passed on to the consumer. The travel agents haven't felt that portion of it, but the consumer has. But yes, I believe the travel agents, for the most part, at least I can speak from our company, have been much more responsible in getting the consumer their money back than these large vendors. They have not been as fast as they should be.
The outbreak of coronavirus could potentially affect also the much larger annual Hajj or pilgrimage. Your company is a major provider for pilgrimage packages for American Muslims. What would happen to those who planned through your company to perform the one-lifetime journey to Mecca?
Our exact policy is anyone who wishes to cancel during the ban, even though the government hasn't officially canceled yet, will be allowed a full refund. And should the cancellation come of Hajj, they will also get a full refund. So on our end, we intend to fully refund everyone their money back. For our company, of course, financially, we're going to take a major hit, unlike anything we've ever been before. But we've been around for 30 years, and we feel that how we behave during this crisis and this period will only strengthen our position and build us loyalty with the clients who will appreciate that we did the right thing during these times. So that is has been our approach to this pandemic.
Many travel agencies like your company deal greatly with pilgrims and other airline trips and are likely to take a major hit, as you said. Would your travel agency benefit from President Trump's stimulus package?
Not nearly enough. The stimulus package only helps travel agencies as so far as it helps any other small business. They recognize that the airlines and the hotels are under unique stresses at the moment, and they've offered the big companies aid. They have not at all looked to the travel agencies or the consolidation market, which is, you know, all the major travel agencies in the country, which is a multi-billion dollar market in itself. They've offered no aid for them whatsoever. So the only thing we're going to benefit from is the paid leave, which is allowed for companies with 500 employees or less. We can get payroll tax deductions later on and still give our employees paid leave, which is better than nothing. But no, we feel the package needs to address the entire line of companies in the supply chain.
So with canceled overseas travel plans and closure of airports and suspension of airline trips, how could you sustain your business?
No company will be able to earn revenue this quarter or next quarter. That's certain, considering what's happening and with the outlook. Our plan has been to, number one, behave ethically and correctly during these times in hopes of retaining business for the future. Try to survive this windfall any way we can by cutting expenses that are unnecessary, and hoping that we are able to sell travel programs for the future.
That was Vice President of Adam Travel, Mohammed Khalil, speaking with VOA Senior Analyst Mohammed El-Shenawi. Before the coronavirus outbreak, a Beijing technology company was already working to integrate autonomous vehicles into daily life in China. They produced pint-sized sidewalk sweepers and delivery robots, but there is now a demand to reversion the technology to take the place of workers who are staying home in the hopes of containing the virus. Matt Dibble has more.
For several years, a small army of autonomous street sweepers has been at work in parks across China, where they have become a welcome sight. Known as Little White Snail, the machines have the features of a full-size street sweeper, but scaled down to a little more than 1 meter high. Since the coronavirus broke out in the city of Wuhan, the little white snails have a more important job, keeping humans safe. Beijing company iDriver Plus was already working to integrate autonomous vehicles into daily life in China, and they saw the pint-sized sweepers as an inroad. Company Vice President Xu Hao Hyo explains.
Because autonomous driving technology is a new technology. It's about safety. In this size, no very sharp angle you can see, so maybe people can accept it easier.
Since the outbreak, over 200 little white snails have been enlisted to fight the spread of the virus. Mike Jellin is an executive with Velodyne LiDAR, which partners with iDriver Plus.
It's now deployed out to the Ho Shenshan Hospital in Wuhan, as well as 11 other hospitals around China, and was called into action to not only help clean, but also to be expanded into disinfecting. So they're spraying vast amounts of disinfectant.
The machines navigate using a combination of pre-programmed maps and real-time sensing, including LiDAR, a system that sends and receives light pulses to create a 3D scan of the ever-changing surroundings. iDriver Plus robots are also delivering meals and medical supplies, reducing human interaction and the risk of exposure. Robots are even being prepared to take on some of the tasks of healthcare workers. iDriver Plus is helping to develop a mobile robotic arm that can take throat cultures and check respiration. As the world fights the pandemic, the quest to save lives is bringing robots in closer contact with humans than ever before. Matt Dibble for VOA News, San Francisco.
It was 37 years ago that Jim Malone joined the Voice of America. Since then, Jim has been an important part of the VOA team, covering Africa, the U.S. House of Representatives, and national politics. Friday, Jim retires. But before he goes, I had the opportunity to sit and talk about his nearly four-decade-long career. I began our conversation by asking him how he got hooked on covering politics.
You know, I think my interest started at a very young age. I can still recall the weekend when President John F. Kennedy was assassinated in 1963, and I think that spurred an interest not only in national politics, but in broadcasting. And that was a seminal moment in our country's history where, for the first time, people came together through television to grieve as a nation and to sort of experience a national tragedy together. I can recall the first time I attended a political rally. It was just out of interest, not of any noticeable support, but it was in 1968 on the Boston Common, and the speaker was then Alabama Governor George Wallace, who was mounting a third-party bid for the presidency. And so I got a firsthand look at what a political rally was like, and it was a rather chaotic scene. But, you know, it just spans the years to think back of how our politics, what's changed, what has remained the same, and sort of trying to always get to that central core of what do the American people want, what do they want to see in their government, and what do they want to see in their leaders.
You bring up a good avenue of discussion as far as how politics have changed throughout the years, because, you know, I'm not as seasoned as you, but I, you know, remember when election cycles were not as long as they are. President Trump started having re-election rallies right after his inauguration, and it's been going on for 3.5 years, almost 4 years now. But, you know, what have you noticed that has changed a lot in terms of how politicians in the United States campaign throughout your almost four decades with VOA?
Right. I mean, I think the campaigns are longer. They start earlier now. I recall that reading about the Kennedy campaign in 1960. John Kennedy, I believe, announced his candidacy on New Year's Day in 1960. Well, now, usually a few years ahead of the election, people are at least planning to run and lining up supporters. There's a 24-hour news cycle you have to tend to. There's the social media channels that you have to, mine and watch. And that goes not only for campaigning, but for fundraising. And there's such a premium now on fundraising that it excludes a lot of people who are not able to raise much money. But even those who can, like a Michael Bloomberg, are not always sort of assured of success. I do think one constant over the years has been when does the American public want change, and when does it want stability? And that'll be an issue for this election year in 2020 as well. But if you look back, some of the key big change election years, 1980, when Ronald Reagan defeated Jimmy Carter, 1992, when Bill Clinton ousted then incumbent President George H.W. Bush, 2008, when Barack Obama came into office, amid the Iraq War and the Great Recession. And then most recently, 2016, a very surprising result with Donald Trump winning narrowly over Hillary Clinton. It's always been fascinating to know why the country has voted for change when it has, and why at times it prefers stability.
That was VOA's national correspondent, well, at least for one more day, Mr. Jim Malone. I'll have the rest of our conversation tomorrow. And with that, that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of the entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to visit our website for in-depth coverage of world events and news 24 hours a day. Simply point your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Have a great day.